brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you? Welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You from HowStuffWorks.com. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Caroline.
Caroline, why don't we start things off with a bit of news?
All right.
It's not new news by now.
Old news?
I think
semi-new news?
Yeah, May news.
People who don't frequently keep up with the news will maybe not have heard about it?
Yes.
There we go.
News for the underinformed. So today we are talking about whether or not a pill can cure obesity and the, in quotes, obesity epidemic that has been sweeping the United States, because an FDA advisory committee recently recommended that the agency approve not one, but two anti-obesity drugs.
Yeah, it starts with Qnexa. Back in February, the committee gave a thumbs up to that drug, which is made by Vivus. It's a drug company.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Vivus. It's pronounced, yeah. Anyway, this is also, there's Lorcaserin. Brand name would be Lorkes, and that is another drug to treat obesity, both of which had previously been rejected after they submitted studies to this advisory committee, and they were like, no, we're not convinced that you won't kill people.
Yeah, for instance, Lorkes was initially red-lighted because the medication seemed to only provide modest weight loss, and there were also some studies linking it to mammary tumors in rats. And so the drug companies went back, they did more studies, they did more tweaking, and came back again, and the FDA advisory committee is like, all right, you know, put it through, pushing it closer to getting these drugs on the market. And just on a side note, just getting that advisory committee green light is such a financial boon for these companies. Right after Lorkes announced that, or I guess Arena Pharmaceuticals that produced Lorkes announced that the FDA advisory committee had given it the thumbs up, shares of its stock skyrocketed 80% immediately.
80%. Well, I mean, I can see that because, you know, there have been, and we'll get into this, but there have been so many attempts at successful obesity drugs that help you lose weight and don't actually weaken your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So if there is something, a promising drug to treat an epidemic that is very widespread, that could potentially make a lot of money for a lot of people.
Absolutely. And there's also the money that goes into all of these clinical trials that the pharmaceutical companies have to fund. But kind of in the back of my mind, I'm always a little wary of all of those hundreds of millions of dollars that are going into these drugs because of the potential to earn money. But my skepticism aside, according to Forbes magazine, Lorkes, and this is now, we're talking in 2012, not 2010 when the FDA initially put the brakes on it. Lorkes helps people lose on average 3% more weight than diet alone, and will also increase the percentage for people who lose 5% of their body weight. So it seems like there's kind of a snowball effect there. The more weight that they're able to lose with medication and dietary changes, because doctors always advise that with clinically obese people, that they've got to have the, it's not just a magic pill, there has to be nutritional change that goes along with that.
And there is more good news, because the senior VP at Arena, the drug company producing Lorkes, says that the cancer they found in these studies is rat-specific.
But it's not all good news, because there are some people out there, some medical experts, who still have concerns about possible heart valve problems.
Yeah.
There are calls for more cardiovascular tests across the board for any kind of anti-obesity drug, probably because of issues with the now defunct Fen-Phen,
right,
which we'll talk about in a minute, that initially people got excited about because, hey, it's easy to lose weight and it's producing all this extra serotonin in your brain, so you feel good while you're doing it. But then down the road, they were like, wait, my heart doesn't work quite right.
Whoops.
And there were also some potential side effects. We're still talking about Lorkes, of headaches and cognitive problems like the potential for amnesia. But then they might just, you know, forget
that they ever had weight problems.
I'm about to argue in favor of amnesia.
Well, it sounds like you take a pill and you end up on a soap opera.
Yeah.
You end up thin with amnesia. But yeah, Kristen just mentioned that there are more tests being called for these types of medications. And back in March, an FDA advisory committee voted to require clinical trials to ensure that obesity drugs do not cause heart attacks. And this sort of caused an argument because some people were saying that this would actually discourage people because it's a very expensive process to go back and do all these tests over and over again. And a lot of tests are performed from the beginning anyway. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people were saying that this added cost, added time would discourage people from developing certain obesity drugs. But then other people are like, hey, shouldn't we err on the side of caution anyway?
Yeah, I mean, and that's okay. So with this issue of whether or not we, like a pill can cure, in quotes, obesity, there are two big things to talk about. What kind of problem are we talking about? Like what is the scope of obesity right now and what might happen if some kind of medication does not get on the market that can cause some significant changes? And also why has it been so difficult to find some kind of anti-obesity medication? So first up, let's talk about just plain stats on obesity. And we're talking about the adult population right now. We're not talking about childhood obesity. Some Duke researchers, this was reported in Slate and USA Today, some Duke researchers project that the percentage of Americans who are severely obese, which would be 100 or more pounds overweight, I'm sorry for metric system listeners right now, I don't have that kilogram conversion.
No, sorry.
Or stones. I wish I knew how many stones that was. But for severely obese people, they're projected to nearly double to 11% of the population by 2030 if we continue in the path that we are on.
And they project that 42% of the population may end up being obese by 2030, which is up from the rate of 36% in 2010.
And if we were to just keep at that level of 36%, and not hit those rising levels, just staying plateaued right where we are. The Duke study co-author, Justin Trogdon, says that the United States alone would save more than $549.5 billion in weight-related medical expenditures through 2030.
That's insane.
And just on another side note, since we're talking about billions of dollars, the U.S. weight loss industry is now estimated at roughly $60 billion. There's so much money everywhere in this conversation.
There is. People are willing to do almost anything to lose weight, except sometimes work out.
Yes.
But that's okay. The projected increased rate of obesity, this whole thing with the Duke research, that means that 32 million more obese people will show up within two decades. Mm-hmm. Show up to the party.
Yeah, and the Duke researchers were trying to figure out the factors that might be going into this forecasting, and they're looking at things like the unemployment rate, prices of fast food, alcohol, and fuel. And if you're thinking about the price of fuel, that ties into this sedentary culture that we live in right now. I mean, I just thinking about myself, like I take public transit to work, mm-hmm. and I still sit constantly.
I actually took public transit yesterday and had a woman lying on me almost. So
I'm sorry, that was me. I was tired.
I was standing, so it was pretty impressive.
That's also my yoga.
Well, I think it is important to ask the question of how accurate are these projections. And Slate did ask that question. They might be a little high, but they're actually pretty accurate. Scarily enough. They point out that in 2003, the CDC predicted that the 2010 rate of obesity would be 40% of Americans, and that was pretty close to the actual rate of 35.7. And we do have to take into account that forecasting like this hasn't been around forever. It's not like we've been tracking obesity rates and predicting them mm-hmm. for more than just about a decade.
Yeah, which is surprising because we hear about mm-hmm. obesity and just weight in general all the time. I feel like we're constantly inundated with information about how to either how we're getting fatter or how to lose all of that fat. It's one or the other. But it really hasn't been around that long, because it was only in 1994 that the Institute of Medicine published a study saying that obesity should be perceived as a chronic condition like hypertension, and recommended that doctors use extended drug therapy or surgery to treat it. It was a complete shift in mindset from just saying, hey, you know, you should just go, you know, diet, exercise, to actually, pathologizing weight. And Scientific American looked into why in that time from 1994, when we have that shift in the medical community and the perception of obesity and then the rising rate of obesity, just to give you an idea, the rates of obesity were stable from 1960 to 1980, around 15% of the population, and then jumped in the 1980s and 90s and hit 32% in 2000. And meanwhile, doctors have tried to develop some kind of anti-obesity drugs, but it has not been an easy thing to do.
No, definitely not. So a 2004 Cornell University study looked at obesity drugs, their success, who is using them, and they looked at 9 FDA-approved obesity treatment drugs in particular that were around between 1996 and 2001, and those were Adipex, Tinuate, Adipost, Didrex, or Didrex, I don't know, these names are getting silly, Mazinor, Pondimin, Redux, Meridia, and Zinical. Whew, that got easier towards the end.
And if those don't ring many bells for listeners, that's because I think Zinical is the only one of these drugs that you can even still purchase.
Yeah, exactly. They tended to have quite a few side effects.
Yeah. And least of which was losing weight.
Yeah. Yes, there was no significant weight loss with many of these. They definitely worked to suppress appetite, but they also tended, you know, to kind of modify your central nervous system neurotransmission. So the side effects could definitely be fatal in some instances, and could have crazy things happen to your heart, your mood, your memory, all sorts of things. And so there's Fen-phen, which we should talk about.
Yes.
Which my mother actually took Fen-phen, and let me just tell you how upset she was. Not about the news about the heart. She was just really angry she had to stop taking it.
Probably because she was going to have a serotonin come down. But tell the kind people out there about the heart valve.
Yeah, Fen-phen was pulled from the market in 97 because it damaged heart valves, which we've mentioned is a side effect of some of these things. And it was a combination of Pondimin, or fenfluramine, which releases extra serotonin, like Kristen said, and the stimulant phentermine. So you've kind of got some ups and downs going here.
Yeah, it was essentially like a drug cocktail, an OTC cocktail, over-the-counter cocktail, that doctors were like, oh, hey, here we go. We can just balance these scales and just lose that weight. But apparently it was tougher on the heart, and the pharmaceutical company has since had to pay lots of money to folks for very expensive surgeries.
Yeah, well, the same year that Fen-phen was yanked off the market, Meridia launched, and it was effective in weight loss, pretty effective. 46% of people lost 10% or more of their body weight in clinical trials, which is significantly more than what we cited for Larkes over here, which was 3% and 5%. But it affected the heart rate and was withdrawn in 2010.
And now it's starting to make sense why these medical experts have recently come out saying, hey, we need cardiovascular tests. They must be rigorous, because all of these former anti-obesity drugs end up being pulled because of heart-related issues.
Yeah. And then we have Zinical, which Kristen points out as one of the few names that I actually recognize. That launched in 1999 and had the not insignificant side effects of oily stools and flatulence. So, God help you if you were taking Zinical and eating Olestra chips.
Well, that's the thing. If you regulated your diet and had a very low-fat diet and Zinical, you'd be fine. But if you decided to splurge and have a parfait or some French fries, then you'd have oily stools. I'll just leave it at that.
Right. Well, that's because your body isn't absorbing it or digesting it. It's
right.
Just passing. The fat is just passing right through you.
And I'm glad you mentioned Olestra chips, because Frontline over PBS did an in-depth story on the Fen-phen craze. And essentially how, you know, in 1994, we have, you know, the studies coming out saying that we need to treat obesity. Obesity is becoming a problem. Mm-hmm. And people start getting aware of it. And we want to lose this weight. And by we, I mean, I'm talking more specifically about Americans. But we don't really want to change our lifestyles necessarily. And so you have all of a sudden this bonanza of low-fat junk food. Mm-hmm. This is when brands like Snackwells come up and make bukus of money because you can still eat cookies because they're just fat-free. Or my favorite product, which I remember when it first came out, I was pretty pumped about it because I liked potato chips, mm-hmm. but it was those Olestra chips, which really did taste like normal potato chips, but they were fat-free. But if you ate too many, you would be on the toilet for quite a while because those fats just slide right through.
Well, we had all of that stuff in my house because my dad had a heart attack in 1995. So that's like right at the peak of all this healthy junk food coming out. And it's like, I know it's really hard. Dieting is a lifestyle change.
Yeah.
And it's hard to all of a sudden go from, you know, eating kind of tasty junk food to being told you need to just stick to fruits and vegetables, basically. So those weird snack foods definitely aided his transition.
And also we have to, you know, acknowledge things like thyroid problems and other genetic problems that might make it harder for you to lose weight or impossible for you to lose weight. And if we're talking about obesity as well, it's not a snap of the fingers, hop on a treadmill, because, you know, there are health problems that could, or health risks that could even go along with intensive exercise. So plenty of doctors have stressed the need for some kind of anti-obesity drug, which does seem like a much better alternative to poop chips.
yes, exactly. But this Cornell study looked at who exactly is taking this medicine. And it's kind of surprising because basically they found that the people who really should be taking it, the severely obese population, only 1.3% of those people who meet the medical criteria are taking the medicine. 41% of those taking anti-obesity drugs don't meet the medical criteria for their use. So that mm-hmm. means that for every 2.29 people, so like two tall people and a short person maybe, for every 2.29 people taking such a drug who meet the criteria, another person using it doesn't.
And we should also emphasize, we probably should have said this earlier in the podcast, we're talking specifically about prescription anti-obesity pills, not
right.
over-the-counter pills if you are, you know, trying to drop a few pounds before, high school
wedding?
Reunion.
Sure.
And we should also say, too, that the Cornell study pointed out that whether or not someone has prescription drug coverage with health care insurance will also make a difference, because those who do are 57% more likely than those without coverage to use anti-obesity drugs. Because I can imagine if these are, you know, there are not generics of these kinds of drugs, and they're probably pretty expensive. So we haven't talked about gender yet in mm-hmm. the podcast, but if we're talking about weight loss, as you can imagine, there is plenty of gendered information out there.
Yeah, according to the National Health and Nutrition Examination study from in 2001-2002, more men than women were overweight or obese, but it looks like more women are actually taking these prescription anti-obesity drugs.
Mm-hmm. Once again, citing that Cornell study from 2004, women are, how about this, 181% more likely to use anti-obesity drugs. And it is probably because women tend to be more motivated to lose weight than men are. Because, well, A, we've talked about before in the podcast how physiologically, it is harder for women to lose weight. Mm-hmm. Men can drop pounds quicker because of the muscle mass, etc. According to a 2011 Gallup poll, 73% of American women have attempted to lose weight an average of 7 times, compared to 55% of men who have attempted to lose weight an average of 4 times. That's a huge gap.
It is a huge gap, and yet women are actually less likely, according to that Gallup poll, to cite exercise
mm-hmm.
As helping them lose weight.
Eating the poop chips.
Oh, God. You've, oh,
God. Sorry. You brought up Olestra.
I did. It is my fault that you called them poop chips. There are other factors that Cornell looked at in looking at who is taking these prescription obesity drugs. They controlled for whether the survey respondents met the medical criteria for using these drugs and found that African Americans were only 42% as likely as whites to use them.
Yeah, and with Hispanics, they were only 71% as likely as whites to use the drugs. So even if, let's say, those two drugs we talked about at the top of the podcast, Lorkes and Qnexa, get the green light, they end up on the market. The question is going to be whether or not they actually get into the hands of the population that medically could benefit from them.
Right.
So that's a big question that we've got to ask. And also in the meantime, there are all these over-the-counter diet pills that I'm sure everyone has seen in drugstores or on advertisements promising to lose weight quickly. And we don't need to go too in-depth on it, except to say that really, don't take them, but I'm saying take the advertisements with a grain of salt.
Yeah, and for Ally, for instance, that over-the-counter diet pill,
mm-hmm.
they encourage you in the ad to make it part of a healthy diet and exercise because, you know, we've already talked about the poop chips. Ally is just Orlistat.
Yeah.
All over again, but it's in a reduced strength version. And so the Mayo Clinic basically tells you that bowel changes will result from the undigested fat moving through your system. So eat that low-fat diet if you're taking an over-the-counter pill like Ally, because it ends up decreasing the absorption of some vitamins.
Yeah, yeah. So you'll need to take those supplements as well. And, of course, the Mayo Clinic urges you to talk to your doctor first. And remember, there are no quick fixes when it comes to popping a pill to lose some weight. Generally, the first course of action is changing the diet and mm-hmm. exercise. With all of these drugs that we have talked about, there's repeated mention of the prescription along with the nutritional counseling to make sure that you're eating more healthily.
Yeah, and who's to say that in the future we won't have a really successful diet drug, one that doesn't cause heart problems, helps you lose weight, and doesn't make you poop all the time.
Right.
In 2010, Scientific American actually pointed out that obesity drugs in the future could be a replacement for weight loss surgery, which, although it is successful for a lot of people, it is pretty dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
So if we end up with a really good, successful, relatively healthy diet drug, anti-obesity drug, you know, maybe that could help with the surgery stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like from what the doctors who are seeing all of these patients are saying, yes, we need some kind of medical treatment as an alternative to something like gastric bypass surgery, but it's hard to figure out how to do that without endangering our hearts mm-hmm. and our brains and our bodies.
Yeah.
So, with that, first of all, I apologize to listeners for the excessive use of the phrase poop chips. And
I think I deserve an apology, too.
And I apologize to you, too, Caroline. And I will now ask for your feedback. What do you think about these anti-obesity drugs? Do you think the FDA should be more careful? Do you think that they should actually speed up the process, get these things on the market? And also advertisements for over-the-counter diet pills, stuff like that. I don't know. Let us know your thoughts. MomStuff@discovery.com is where you can send your letters. In the meantime, we've got a couple here from some older episodes. My first email here from Nicole is in regard to our long ago podcast on gender segregated education. She writes, I went to an all-girls Catholic high school. At that age, being in an all-girls class was great, mostly because I was so shy. It really helped me build confidence. Plus, there were less distractions in the classroom. We never had much trouble finding dates. You guys mentioned that girls may be more awkward around guys since they wouldn't have as much experience socializing with them. Totally not true. After high school, I went to college to get a degree in civil engineering, so I had class with a lot of guys and almost all of my professors were guys. Sometimes I was the only girl in class, but I got used to it very quickly and it wasn't too awkward. It was actually quite nice. Since you're the only girl, the guys tend to remember you. So occasionally at a house party, I got to cut the keg line and even scored a few free beers at the bar. My housemates were a little jealous that the nerdy girl knew so many guys. It's always nice to cut a keg line.
It is. That's what I always say.
Indeed.
This is an email from Hannah about the midwife episode. She said, I just finished listening to your episode on doulas and midwives and thought I'd pipe in with my story, even if I'm a year late. I gave birth 8 months ago and had both a midwife and a doula. I also delivered at a birthing center. And I can say from experience that having both was the most important thing I ever did. I am considered low income, and my doula decided to provide her services free of charge. And it was because of her that I had an unmedicated, i.e. natural, birth. This woman had no painkillers. At the times when I was overcome, it was her soothing voice that kept me going. After I gave birth, there were some complications. I had hemorrhaging. My midwife not only kept a cool head, but also didn't just wait around until the medics came. She acted quickly and ended up saving my life. However, when I was transferred to the hospital, my midwife was able to stay. My doula was told she had to leave. I was pretty out of it at the time, so I didn't know what was going on. After I came out of my daze, I was so furious that a hospital which claims to be very woman-centered with the best obstetrics around didn't have enough respect to allow my doula to stay. Perhaps doulas are seen as pushy and nonconformist, but mine isn't, and is the sweetest, most gentle woman I know. We are still in contact, and I count her as a friend.
So, thanks to everybody who's written in. MomStuff@discovery.com is where you can send your letters. You can also find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at MomStuffPodcast. And if you would like to see what we're up to during the week, you can head over to our website. It's HowStuffWorks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?